And welcome to She Thinks, a podcast where you're allowed to think for yourself. I'm your host, Beverly Hallberg. And on today's episode, Anna Giratelli joins us to discuss the state of the border, including the latest numbers of illegal crossings and the political fight on how to address it. But she's also joining us to talk about something else, a major issue in this country, rising crime in cities. Anna recently bravely has come forward with her own story of being tragically attacked in Washington, D.C. She's going to talk about that with us today, what it's meant to her, the impact to other victims, and also her process of moving forward. So before we jump into that conversation, a little bit more about Anna. Anna Giratelli joined the Washington Examiner in 2015 and focuses on homeland security, immigration, and border issues. She's traveled to the border on more than 40 occasions since 2018 and has covered human smuggling, the evolution of the war on drugs, domestic terrorism, and migration trends. She is currently based in Austin, Texas. Anna, thank you so much for joining us again on She Thinks.
Yeah. Hi, Beverly.
And I'm excited to get into the topics all about the border. You're one of my favorite reporters when it comes to border issues. You always give really good information and data that's not out there, but we are starting with something personal. I did not expect to have this conversation with you, even when this podcast was scheduled. I didn't know that you were willing to talk about this in a public way. But you posted on Instagram last week on the 4-year anniversary on tragically being attacked in Washington, D.C. And so you're willing to talk about that and rising crime in cities. So I want you to share your story on your own terms and what you feel comfortable with. We do know that crime is increasing across the country. It's a major concern, but you experienced it personally. Can you first of all just tell us why have you decided to talk about this 4 years later? What was the precipitous for you to talk about it?
Yeah, it's been a long 4 years, certainly. Really the moment that changed things, you know, I've wanted to talk about it since it happened, since that day, but I've waited, forced myself to wait because I knew that, oh, there's still a lot of anger here. There's still more, you know, healing to be done. Not that we ever become fully healed, but to be in a better place. And on April 4th, just, you know, last week, I saw the tweet. You'd actually tweeted about your business being the anniversary. And I said, oh my goodness, today's 4 years since I was attacked. And I didn't even realize it until, you know, that afternoon, seeing someone write, April 4th makes the anniversary. And to me, I was like, I didn't even, you know, normally you track these dates. It's coming. And even a few weeks earlier, I'd been like, okay, I know this date is coming up. It's going to be fine. I'm in a different place now. I'm much better. But, That is actually your tweet of all things that reminded me, oh my goodness. And it was that night, you know, there's something in me that wanted to share what happened to me. I disappeared out of DC a couple of years ago. People don't really know what happened. And, you know, wanted to come out and share it really, and hopefully be a resource to people who, oh my goodness, how many millions of women in, you know, DC and the country have been victims of physical assault or sexual assault in varying degrees, in varying situations, and just share what happened to me and the context which it happened and how I've been able to move through it. Not because I got it right, but because I think there's just power in sharing your story. And that's why I came forward and you know, I got a lot of support from my company and from other reporters, national reporters in the media, especially women. Women get it.
Yeah. And I remember, I think it was when you were on the podcast last, which was probably roughly a year ago, you told me about this prior to us recording. You said something like, hey, I just want to let you know this happened. Don't really want to talk about it. And of course, I was super understanding of that. And so when I saw your post, you, like I said, you were already scheduled. And I just thought, wow, first of all, it's been 4 years. And then you mentioned the date, April 4th. And one of the things I was wondering, just as you're talking about the significance of the date, would you say that it's another phase of healing when the date you forgot about it. I almost feel badly that I mentioned April 4th as an anniversary because it made you think of it, but maybe that's a good thing in the process of healing. Do you think that that is a good step that you did forget it was April 4th until you saw somebody writing about April 4th being significant?
Definitely, Beverly. It was definitely, it just goes to show, you know, it's kind of in the back of your mind. You know, you're always going to think about it. It's like something, you know, horrible that happened to you, but certainly, yeah, moving forward and not thinking about the date, it feels really good.
Yeah. And I'm a firm believer in the power of speaking of things that have happened to you, because I feel like they don't have the same hold on you when you can be open and free about talking about them. But it has to be in somebody's with the right time at the right healing process. And so I want to take us back to that day on April 4th, 4 years ago. Only share what you feel comfortable sharing. So I'm going to leave that up to you. But what some significant things I think people need to know about this as you explain is, so this is right after COVID. So what are we, 3 weeks after everything shuts down? We are also talking about 9:45 in the morning. Was this a work day, a weekday?
It was a Saturday morning.
But, and you said it was near Union Station, which is for some context for people who don't live in Washington, D.C. There's a ton of crime there now, but that used to be a major hub for people. The metro is there. I lived about 5 blocks from there, walked to Union Station all the time. I've been very open on this podcast about moving and leaving Washington, D.C. due to increased crime and not feeling safe there anymore. So take us back to that morning. Were you running errands? What were you doing and what happened?
Yeah, I lived, so this was a Capitol Hill area. So, you know, very safe overall. I've been living in DC almost 7 years at that point, downtown. So I was a, you know, real district lady. And I cover federal law enforcement every day. So crime is something that is, you know, it's just what I do for a living. It's being, you know, covering it, working with law enforcement, knowing how to take care of myself as a single person living alone all those years in DC. You know, I've prepared, you know, what would I do if someone ever mugged me? I've always thought of all these things, right? I hadn't prepared for what if someone tried to kill me, because you just don't think it's going to happen. And that morning I was running to the post office several blocks away. Put on some black sweats, walked out the front door of my apartment station house, and was walking just toward Union Station. And while I was walking, undistracted, a large man, charged at me on the sidewalk, a stranger, and wrapped his arms around me and was screaming things, you know, not at me necessarily, but just screaming, and was taking me down. And in that process, he also sexual assaulted me. And in that moment, I'm fearing I'm being killed. Someone is trying to kill me. This was as violent as you can imagine, without him pulling anything out on me, weapon-wise. It was shocking. You're in shock. It's the moment you don't realize you're in fight, flight, or freeze. You're just like, this has happened to me right now. And I was able to scream. I screamed bloody murder. It was my only power in that moment. This man was huge. And someone heard me and did come to my aid. And did save me from you know, going further. And the gentleman, calling him a gentleman, the guy who attacked me, I don't intend to name his name through all this. My name has been protected through all of the court proceedings. So me coming out is me being public to him for the first time. He's never known or seen me, except for that day. But he ran away. And so, you know, I remember even the moments, the very seconds after, it's all a blur still. But I think we should call the police. it doesn't dawn on you, you know, when you're in the middle of it, an actual crime just happened. You think of, oh, that was weird. That was
Yeah. Like, was that as
okay.
bad as I thought? And it's almost like your mind
Exactly.
protects you from how bad it is.
And people came running over like in shock. And yeah, and they're like, okay, we'll stand here with you. Are you okay? You know, and you're like, you know, I don't remember any of that, the details of it until, yeah. So that was,
Yeah.
you know, certainly in DC, you can't open carry, you can't carry a weapon, even concealed. Well, I think it's extremely limited. I'm not sure how it is now. I didn't own a gun, I didn't have anything. I had a large knife that a border patrol agent or ICE agent had given me years ago on the border for when I would drive up and down the border. Didn't have it on me. You know, I think in the initial aftershock for weeks, I was furious with myself for not doing more. I was furious I didn't think to fight back. I was furious I froze. I was furious, honestly, that this had happened to me, because here's my story: is I was sexually assaulted when I was 17. It would be considered a statutory crime, right? Because you can't consent in the state I was in at 17, and a 21-year-old guy used substances to yeah. So that was the week of this attack. I have to 15-ish years ago. I have to look at math, but about 15 years ago. And so right after the attack, while I'm in my apartment, the police are taking my clothes for DNA evidence, to run them through the system. It dawns on me, oh my goodness, what's wrong with me? Why am I doomed? Why do bad things happen to me? Nothing good is coming for me. You know, and I'm asking God, like, what is the significance of this week? Why does this keep happening? Yeah. That was
So
a
you said something interesting that I want to focus on just a little bit, because I've heard this from other women before too, is whether other people ask them, family members or friends or cops or counselors or whatever it is, it's why didn't you fight back harder? And I think what people probably don't understand when you're in that situation, it's a shock. And I'm sure there's a fear that if I fight back hard, this could be worse for me. And so you're trying to make judgments in the moment, you screaming to try to get people around you. But I think there's a lot of second guessing by other people, not blaming you for it, but just trying to understand. But I think unless you're in that moment, first of all, no one knows how they're going to respond. It's going to be situational. Where are you? What can you do? Have you been able to work through fighting the blame that you put on yourself, because it's not your fault? I don't know why these things happen to you twice, in different ways, but have you worked through that self-blame and self-shame?
yeah. And you know, the first attack when I was 17, I shouldn't say it's an attack, the first incident when I was 17 was something I was still working through, sort of blindly, you know, trying to figure out how that affected me now. I'm 35, four right now. I turn 35 next month. And yeah, so the assault happened when I was 30. And the assault in DC, really, the process for healing has allowed me to really get through what happened to me years ago in high school. It took, I think the hardest thing is knowing that you're going to get there, because in the moment it was, and in the weeks after, just total chaos in my head. I could not understand what I was about to go through. Like, the attack was bad, right? But then you're like, I remember sitting in my bedroom right after I gave them my clothes for DNA. And I was like, well, there goes my favorite sweatshirt, but I don't want it back. It's just like, you know, it's funny thoughts and thinking, I'm scared for what the next chapter of life is going to look like for me. I don't, Because, like, in a way, nothing has changed, and yet everything has changed. And unless, I say this with love, unless you have been attacked physically or sexually, it, and they're all very different, right? Just very different types of things can happen. It is, you cannot put yourself in the shoes of someone who's been through something.
Right.
I still have trouble saying I survived this attack.
Right.
Because you're right, family and friends are, they mean well, but it is so hard for people to understand and communicate well to a victim, and even the victim themselves. Like, I'm like, I should have taken care of myself. And I immediately started therapy, I think like
Good.
2 or 3 weeks after, and started doing a process called EMDR. I can't remember what it stands for, but basically you're going back into that moment through a certain psychotherapy process, and you're reliving that moment and you're bringing it all back up to the surface, taking it out of the part of the brain where trauma is stored, and reprocessing it in sort of a rational, your frontal lobe, and then it's storing rationally. So I can talk about all this right now as matter of fact. I still feel like, I haven't come out publicly and talked about it on camera, so it's a little like, oh, okay. But
Like we're in this phase now. Okay,
exactly, yeah.
next
So
phase.
this is a huge first step for me. But yeah, it took, that was brutal, bringing all that back to the surface. That was weeks of really hard to reprocess that and have that kind of front and center in your mind. But yeah, through time, I remember one day, months later, thinking, I really did the best I could that day. And my therapist, I've seen three therapists since then. I've been out of therapy for a year and a half now, I think. And they've each lent great wisdom and help to me through this. And one of them, the first one, I remember her saying, like, what could you have done? Like, if you go back in that moment, I knew this man was deranged. I knew he was crazy because he was screaming stuff while taking me down. I knew, my first thought covering crime is like, this guy could be on meth. He could be extremely physically capable right now, and I don't want to be up. He's already huge. I don't want to be up against a huge guy with a lot of strength. I could kick him, in the groin while I'm going down, or, try to get out. But I screamed, and really, it turned out to be, I really believe it was the right thing for me to do.
And one of the things that when I hear your story that I think is obviously there's that the personal side that you're dealing with. But if you would have said to me that morning, hey, it's a Saturday morning, I'm gonna go walk to the post office, I wouldn't think to tell you, make sure you take a knife or a gun. And you've covered crime, so you know this better than I do. But one of the things I've noticed in cities, there used to be rules to crime. Like your fear was getting mugged someday, right? You don't think about this. And you're also, okay, make sure it's daytime in the right areas. Like you just knew as a single woman, if I follow these normal rules, the criminals aren't going to attack me. It's not in their best interest, right? It's not going to serve them well to attack. It seems like there are no rules to crime anymore. And when there aren't, not that there should ever be rules to crime, so to speak, there shouldn't be crime, but it's the most vulnerable women, children, the elderly, who are the ones who live in fear because unless another man comes and helps because you scream, you have no other recourse.
Yeah, exactly. I've played it so safe in DC for so many years. Okay, I want to go to the Ross Dress for Less. That's not in the best area. I'll take the bus during the middle of the day, and I won't have my headphones in, and I'll pay attention. Like, I'm the person telling the people around me, hey, you shouldn't be doing this in public. You should be more focused on this. And so when I was, you know, telling my story, I feel like not paranoid, but like, I want to tell everyone, like, it was the morning, it was daytime. I wasn't dressed scandalously. I was in baggy sweats. I wasn't on my phone. I was paying attention to my surroundings. I did everything right. And yet this happened to me.
Yeah.
And that, I think, was really a pivotal moment, because after the attack, I went deep into anxiety and panic attacks. Like, it was terrifying. I've dealt with, you know, anxiety to, you know, level varying extents before that, but this was wiped me out. And I went home to my parents out of state for 3 months, lived with them, and they kind of brought me back to life. I would categorize it as a negative, or I'm sorry, just a breakdown, a total breakdown, based on what I've read about this now. And moved back to DC with my mom to that apartment and said, you know, I'm gonna get through this. I'm gonna get over it. It's fine. But this is all during the George Floyd riots in DC. There's so much going on in DC. It's an election year, so November's coming, and I live downtown. So it's things like in DC get all boarded up, and it's just, it's not like, you know, it's not like any other city in America. And so I, you know, after a month of going back there, I was like, I can't stay in this apartment. I don't feel safe.
Yeah.
And so I moved across town several miles away to an area that was secluded by itself, and tried to, you know, plug away there. DC, we didn't go back to work, to offices until, what was it, like fall 2022?
Yeah.
So I'm just working at home every day by myself in my 420 square foot apartment, trying to heal, not seeing people, because you're still like not seeing anyone. And yeah, that was my next step, and just staying secluded and thinking I was healing, which I was, but also you need people around you physically to carry you through this, even months after something's happened.
Yeah. Something that in some ways is comforting, but in some ways is hard, is you said, I now realize I didn't do anything wrong, which is true. Absolutely true. You didn't do anything wrong. But that also means there's nothing you can change to prevent it from happening again. Like, sometimes I think we want to know, what could I have done differently? Mm-hmm. And how do you process the fact that you did everything right? And what does that do as far as your fear just moving forward in life? And how have you worked through that?
That was a lot to, to work through. Because if I know I failed, I can do better next time and avoid this. That was where I had a lot of anger towards DC. This man who attacked me, I only found this out 2 years later at sentencing. He had attacked an off-duty DC police officer, a woman, in the same neighborhood weeks earlier. He wasn't caught, but she survived. And then after my attack in April 2020, we were supposed to go to court that fall. We were supposed to start. And it got delayed till the beginning of 2021, right after the January 6th riots, which I'm sure everybody understands. There's been hundreds of people prosecuted for that. U.S. Attorney's Office in D.C. has been very busy. So I got delayed again to the fall. so that was incredibly frustrating, as, you know, being like, well, I got assaulted first. Can we focus on my incident and get through this? It was also very frustrating because when I moved to this apartment, I was living near Georgetown on the other side of downtown DC. And I had looked at crime maps, because this is what I do for a living. I'm all up. I know where all the crime data is. I'm looking at the public crime maps and was looking at individual blocks to see, okay, are there certain blocks in this area that are better than others? Because I will literally base my move on safety.
Right.
And when I looked at this block, it was like, okay, this is the best bet. This is great. And come to find out after the attack, I'm writing about civil unrest in DC and crime, as was my beat as a Homeland Security reporter. Did a story on is crime and violent crime in DC rising amid COVID. And it was May 2020. And I looked at crime for April 2020, which was when I was attacked. I'm looking at the violent crimes. There's, trying to think of them, there's sexual abuse, robbery, homicide, murder, these types of felony level crimes. My assailant was charged with and convicted of a sexual abuse crime, which includes the physical assault. And it was not a first degree, it was not a rape. And so it was a lower degree. But I looked at the crime map and I look at where I was attacked, and there's no dot on the map like there are others. And I thought, oh, and I'm reading the details, like, I have to understand this, right? Okay, mine should be there. It doesn't take like, more than a, few weeks for this is what happened in April. This is the arrest we made, or the incidents we investigated. I look at my home address across the street, nothing. Let me look at my last previous address, nothing there. And so I reached out to DC Police, the Metropolitan Police Department, and said, I'm a reporter, but I'm also a victim, and I'm writing a story about crime, and I happen to notice my attack isn't on the crime map. And it makes you doubt yourself, like,
Like, did it really happen? If
what? I
it,
was like,
what did they
did I
say?
forget to put this up? And they wrote back 2 weeks later,
Oh my goodness.
which for a reporter is like, geez Louise, man, my deadline was 2 weeks ago. Wrote back 2 weeks later, and the DC Police Department says, your incident was not a first degree crime. We only put first degree felonies on this public map. That was
That had been so painful.
infuriating for two reasons. Because one, I based my move on this map. And had I had a full picture, because here's the thing, just look at sex abuse crimes, first degree rape, there's going to be far fewer rapes than there are second, third, fourth degree sexual abuse crimes. There's going to be way more, not just because there's three categories, but because it's a lot easier to molest somebody than, to go all the way to raping somebody. And so not being able to get a full context of all the felonies, not just sex abuse on the map, was, I would have redone the whole move had I had a full picture. And then two, it was like the DC Police Department was gaslighting me.
It wasn't
And
that bad, Anna. It wasn't that bad to even
it
make
wasn't
fun
that
of.
you didn't get raped. It's fine.
Rub some dirt on it. You're fine.
That pissed me off.
Of course.
That still upsets me. And I haven't written about it. I've been sort of prodding through the years of that. That's still really, because I think of other women, even my apartment. And I'll say it here, I lived at Station House
I know
Apartments.
exactly where that is. It was 2 blocks from where I lived.
They charged me $2,200 to break my lease and move out early. I reported the crime the day it happened. I said, the US Attorney's Office is prosecuting this. This isn't like someone grabbed my wallet and run, which is still a thing. This is like something serious happened. And they didn't even announce it to residents to put out a memo, say, just so you know, a resident was attacked today outside the building. I've spoken with management. They have a new management, but I spoke with the old management and said, you need to, first of all, can I get a refund for that move out fee? Because that was ridiculous. Second of all, which they did not. Second of all, you need to have women's best interests in mind and men's best interests, because had I known there was a crazy man who was physically assaulting and trying to kill people outside the building, I would have rethought going out if I was a different resident in that building. So, yeah. So I think you take all of that and say, obviously, I think time is so big for just working through anger and disappointment. The system that's there to protect you didn't. And then looking forward and saying, not only how can I help other women and victims, there's a better way to report police stats. You know, I don't know what the intention is behind only showing some stats and not others. I think we all can, you know, propose it's to make it look not as bad as it really is. But yeah, I think we want to know how bad it is. Police certainly know. But someone at the top of the Metropolitan Police Department is making calls that I don't think the public would stand behind.
You know, there's probably this element where it feels ironic that you're a crime reporter, right? And you're dealing with this. But I think due to your knowledge and your skill as a reporter, there is a story that you're going to write coming out that is going to shine a light on this, because I think there's so much that people feel, especially the vulnerable, like I was saying, women, elderly, children, especially women though, in cities where we know it's worse than they're saying. It's worse than they're saying. And I hope you write that story. I hope you do. And so my question to you is, how has it made you, or has it improved your reporting? How is this, especially since you deal with crime issues even, and we're going to talk about the border and what's going on there. I mean, you're seeing women who have been sexually assaulted coming across the border, right? How has this impacted your work for better, for worse, in between, or have you had to kind of shut out your thoughts about your own experience in relation to your writing?
Yeah, that was something that's been very challenging. I've been to the border 60 times now since 2018.
Wow. Okay. And
obviously we're living through a crisis that is in year four now under the Biden administration. For context, real quick, normally before Biden, we'd see about 30 to 50,000 people arrested crossing the border every month. It's still a huge figure. Under Biden, we're seeing upwards of 300,000 arrests per month. And it hasn't died down. It hasn't stopped. We've just been, you know, grown accustomed to it. And in Congress, you'll hear in hearings all the time, stats like one in three women coming over the border has been sexually abused to some degree. And that's just what women are reporting.
Right.
I think that's such a huge thing. And when I say women, I mean girls, boys. It's disgusting. It's infuriating. I think. I've always taken my job seriously, very seriously. I love what I do. After the attack, my first few trips back to the border later that year brought a lot of panic. I came back from one trip and just was eating breakfast and thought, I think I'm having a heart attack. And so I went to the hospital and they did EKG and hooked me up and everything. And they said, you're having a panic attack. Because what you're seeing on the border, I'm used to it. Border patrol agents are, you think I'm used to it. The things they see, that's why I'm, you know, going to write about my story. But it's made me more empathetic. And, you know, one of the things my mom has said to me since I was a little kid is, Anna, you are the most compassionate person I know. Like if I drive by someone who's homeless, I pray for them. I'm also very black and white judgmental. So it's always a wrestle in me. But in 2021, I went to the border in Eagle Pass, Texas, and I saw a group of people from Venezuela coming across, and they had a dog with them and they got taken into custody. Border Patrol says, sorry, you can't take the dog with you. They traveled by foot from Venezuela, thousands of miles through the Darien jungle with this dog. And Border Patrol says, you can't take it with them. And I don't blame Border Patrol. That's the policy on the books. You can't bring animals into the United States in that, you know, crossing between the ports of entry. So this little white dog is sitting there. I got bit by a dog similar to this one as a kid. I'm not a big dog person. I do cats. And I'm sitting there, these people get taken away in the van, and I'm looking at this dog on the riverbank, destitute. And I said to the Texas National Guard, "What's going to happen to the dog?" And one of the soldiers, like 18, 19-year-old guy, was just like, he'll just be fine." And I can't leave this dog here.
Right.
I'm like, can I even get it back to its owner? I have no idea how I'm going to go about this. So I started making calls. I started calling city officials I knew. I called in a favor of Border Patrol with someone really high up. I said, "Nine people just got taken into custody. I'm going to drop you a pin on a map of where I am because you can't really see on the border. I'm on the border. Someone just got to." They're like, "Where? Like,
At
what's
the four-way
the?"
stop near the Rio Grande
Yeah,
that
they're like, "Well, what part of the 2,000 miles? You can't even say like I'm in this town." They're
Yeah.
like, "Well, they're taking into 2,000 people a day sometimes in Eagle Pass, this one town." We were able to figure out, and I didn't get the people's names where they're taking into custody because I thought the dog was going with them. So they get taken into custody. We end up getting their names. They're notified by this person I'm working with in Border Patrol, "Hey, your dog has been saved by that reporter on scene. It's in police custody now, which is going to give it to a rescue group who's going to watch over it while you're in custody until you get released, because we assume they're going to get released into the country," which they were. And so they ended up getting reunited. That's a whole story in and of itself. And I really got to know the young woman whose dog it was. But it was, I think, things like that have helped me see it's I hate saying this, but it's hard when you see what you see every day at the border. Remember that not just that these are people, but this is someone who is as much value as me.
Yeah.
I think of like loving others more than yourself.
Yeah.
And I think going through what I'm going through, I mean, I'm still a wreck at this point, and I'm on a border trip thinking I'm fine after the attack. I'm back to normal. It's been a year. I wasn't. But that's I think how I've seen, things play out, just in my own life of people, their own struggles. And it's here's the thing, Beverly. People don't come up to you on the street and say, "Hi, I'm a crime victim. Can you
Right.
console me? Can you give me advice?" That's all I wanted after the attack. I just wanted to scream and be like, "Someone help me, because I don't understand what's going on." And it doesn't seem complicated from the outside. It's like, well, don't you get a court date and you just show up? It's especially after a sex crime. It's so damn personal. It's so different than other crimes. And also just fighting for your life. You're like, I really want to live through this. I really, and now you live and now you're like, well, now what? What
Right.
did I fight for? So
So,
I, yeah, it has
yeah.
really, I think it's really brought to the surface who I am deep down. And I'm learning that. I feel like I've really gotten to. We talk about finding yourself, and I'm always like, oh, make fun of that. But I think I'm really realizing who I am when you take away a lot of noise. And I want to help people. And I say that in a very humble way.
And I've always hated when I've heard somebody say to somebody who has been a victim of something, they say, "Well, you had something to learn." I've always hated that. Can you learn from bad things that happen? Sure, you really can, but it doesn't mean that it happened because you had something to learn. Unfortunately, terrible bad things happen to people and it doesn't make sense. And I don't think asking the why is always helpful. But one final question for you, just as you share that your story here today. And by the way, I think it's going to open up so many more conversations with women who've been through something similar. I think that's what you're going to experience. But I want to close by thinking about just crime as a whole. You report on the border, you've been a victim of crime in cities. How bad is it, especially when you talk about police aren't even reporting what they would view as not the most heinous of crimes, but obviously a very tragic, terrible crime.
I got to the point where, you know, having moved in DC to this new location a year after the attack, or months anyway, where I didn't feel like I could rely on the system or I could even protect myself, even if I had a gun. I think that says how bad it is. So I left DC and I moved to Texas on a whim. It wasn't a political move. I had family here. I've never been to my family. I have some nephews here, and something about being around such wholesome babies. I mean, we know how kids are, right? But wholesome people who could actually support me through, you know, the next chapter. And that chapter has now turned into almost 3 years of living in Texas.
Yeah.
Which has put me very conveniently closer to the border.
Well, in closing, go ahead.
You know, I got a gun when I first moved to Texas, and that was something I had to wrestle through. Am I willing to use this to defend myself? I think crime, certainly, you know, I see it within the illegal immigrant community extensively more than even in, I think, the public, because you have to think of it this way. The gangs and cartels are in every city in this country. It would blow your mind if the public understood how extensively. And their easiest victims for all sorts of things is the community that is scared to come forward to police to report something. Even if they came over the border legally, got a paper saying you're allowed to be in the country until your court proceeding in 5 years, that person living in, say, the Bronx in New York, something happens, they get mugged at gunpoint, you know, by someone they know. They're not coming forward.
Right.
They are not coming forward because a lot of people are coming from countries where they fear the police. The police are not good people. The government is not good. And so you have that stereotype portrayed onto the U.S. police. And not every police officer is great either. You never know, you know, what's going to happen. So it's even worse in immigrant communities, the crime. And, you know, we've seen the looting, the rioting, the shoplifting, the retail theft, which I write about extensively, is mind blowing, and it's fueling all this criminal networks are getting more and more powerful. These aren't like criminal groups or gangs. These are like corporations underground that have major roots in everything. And I think with the border crisis, what scares me is not just the people getting released, but the people who get away that we've seen. We've seen, I think it's almost 2 million people since Biden took office. Border Patrol has seen them cross, but not been able to arrest them. Wow. And this is like at the border, the cartels will push across a group of 100 people, families and children. Okay. Pulls all the agents into this area. Okay. We got to get car seats for the cars. We can't just take kids to the station anymore. Now we need car seats, but we need a coach bus because there's so many people. So everybody gets pulled in. And then at 10 miles down the river, the cartels are saying, okay, these 10 guys who don't want to get caught because they've been deported, they might have a criminal record, they might be on a terror database, we're going to push them across, and we're going to push across some meth, cocaine, maybe some fentanyl. No one's going to have, and we see it. We're like, Border Patrol has great technology that Congress has given them, but it's like, okay, there's some activity over there, but we're stuck right here right now. We don't have the resources to deal with that. That is what like actually keeps me up some nights.
Yeah.
Thinking about that threat. And I think the Secretary of Homeland Security would actually agree with that. You don't know what's coming in. And it's not just excess of people seeking help, like migrants. It's, you know, it doesn't need to be someone who's ready, wanting to come to commit a terrorist attack. It's It's like you're avoiding, you know, going to the port of entry and seeking refuge, seeking right. asylum. Yeah, that's what, when I think about the gang members and the cartels that have people who are coming in now and setting roots down, that's something that doesn't scare me necessarily for tomorrow, but 3 years from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, especially in major cities where they have their biggest strongholds.
And this is why I think your reporting is so good, because you do peel back the layers and look at the networks that are underneath. And like you said, it may not present danger to the extent that it will years from now, but it's there and it's growing. And I just want to thank you, not just for your reporting, but also sharing your story today. I'm sure this wasn't easy. It's not a fun thing to talk about, but I think it's a sign of your strength and your healing. And I do know that you're already using something terrible that happened to you that was not your fault at all in any way for good. And I think there's going to be some good articles coming from you that maybe shine a light more on the corruption and how crime is reported, and just also talk about your healing. So Anna Giratelli with the Washington Examiner, everybody should check out your work. Thank you so much for joining today and sharing.
Thank you, Beverly.
And thank you all for joining us. Before you go, IWF does want you to know that we rely on the generosity of supporters like you. An investment in IWF fuels our efforts to enhance freedom, opportunity, and well-being for all Americans. So please consider making a small donation to IWF by visiting IWF.org/donate. That is IWF.org/donate. Last, if you enjoyed this episode of She Thinks, do leave us a rating or review. It does help. We love it if you shared this episode so your friends can know where they can find more She Thinks. From all of us here at Independent Women's Forum, thanks for watching.